This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome to the Trumpet's weekly review of all the important news. I'm Jeremiah Jacques, filling in for your regular host, Mr. Joel Hilliker, today. And with me is our panel. Here in the studio, we have Andrew Miller.
Hello.
And joining us from a field office in Alberta, Canada, is Richard Palmer.
Good morning.
And Skyping in from the UK, we have Mihailo Zekic.
Hello.
In what may go down as the most significant attempt in the modern era to expand the power of America's executive branch, President Joe Biden has announced a series of sweeping vaccine mandates which could affect 100 million people. To bring us up to speed on this, we'll go to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, the Biden administration is becoming infamous for its executive overreach and unconstitutional power grabs. In many cases, such as the eviction moratorium, where they even admitted that it was unconstitutional and did it anyway. But as you said, probably the most significant power grab so far has been these vaccine mandates the administration rolled out on September 9th. And it comes really in the form of three executive actions. The first executive action was the Biden administration mandating that all federal employees get vaccinated for COVID-19 as a term of their employment. The second order was for all federal contractors to do the same thing. And the third and probably most significant order was directive from OSHA, basically directing all private employers with more than 100 employees to mandate that their employees get vaccinated for the COVID vaccine, or at least if they outright refuse to do that, get tested for COVID-19 once a week. And so just looking at this from like a legal standpoint is like maybe a good lawyer could argue that the first two actions to vaccinate all the federal employees and all the federal contractors are within its legal realm, since the federal government is your employer. But this last one, using OSHA to make the private sector vaccinate people, I mean, that's basically the government telling you what you have to put in your body. There's no constitutional provision for that. They haven't even attempted to make a constitutional provision by having Congress pass a law. They're just using this executive agency, the OSHA, to pass this regulation by fiat, which, like I said, the Constitution says any power not explicitly delegated to the federal government into the Constitution goes back to the people or to the states, not to the occupational Health and Safety Administration.
Well, there's quite a lot to unpack with all of this, and we know that there's been just a huge amount of opposition to these announcements already. How do you anticipate it going from here?
Well, it looks like already there's going to be a number of states, probably most the middle states of the country, most of the conservative states that voted for Trump, that are really going to challenge this, and in some cases may just outright refuse to obey this OSHA mandate, which is within their legal right to do. Like I said, it's not constitutional. They don't have the supreme law of the land says that they don't have to obey it. But it is really going to increase even more so the division in America, where we have several issues now. Gun control's one, vaccination is another, where the federal government's making these sweeping unconstitutional standards for everyone to abide by, and then the state governments are picking a side where they're either saying like, okay, well, we'll let the federal government make this decision, or we won't. And so it's almost kind of like you have to go back to like the Civil War era before you see like this level of division between even states just saying that like, well, we're not going to obey these rules coming out of the federal government.
So in some ways, this with the division that you're talking about here, that this is bringing about, it almost looks like part of a coordinated attempt to divide the country and to destroy the republic. What can you tell us about that?
Right. Our executive editor, Mr. Stephen Fleury, did a trumpet brief last week entitled Joe Obama's Priorities, Defend the Taliban and Attack America, where he really went through there just kind of the tragic irony of the fact that in Joe Biden's speech introducing these vaccine mandates, you could just see just a ton of visible anger with him, where he's talking about how tough he's going to crack down on the unvaccinated and how these people are destroying America. And this is coming just days and weeks after his debacle in Afghanistan, talking about how the Taliban's our allies and that there aren't really that many Americans that he abandoned in the country when there's really 500. So he's actually just really exhibiting a much more hate and anger towards like unvaccinated Republicans than he even is towards terrorists in the Middle East, which you can't explain except for the fact that it is an orchestrated attempt to destroy the country, empowering our enemies while systematically destroying our civil liberties here at home. And then they just touched on that prophecy we've come back to so much on this show in 2 Kings 14, verses 26 through 29, where it talks about this this effort to blot out the name of Israel, or like look at the name, like blot out the values that Israel stands for, all the constitutional freedoms, all your positive influence in the world. You're looking at places where America, like Afghanistan, where America has brought peace and education to millions, and then just turning that over to some of the worst terrorist organizations in the world, and then downplaying your role in that while really focusing in on the government's right to tell you what vaccinations to inject in your body. And there's even the liberal scientists are coming out now saying that some of these vaccines, like I said, they don't actually protect you against COVID. That's why they're still asking for the mask, which don't actually protect you against COVID either. They just reduce the effects. And so you're okay, so if it just reduces the effects, then it really should be a personal decision whether you get it or not. But it is almost like a psychological form of mind control the Biden administration is trying to use in this attempt to blot out these freedoms that we've enjoyed for so long. It's just like it's like with the lockdowns, it's like you force someone to do it, and then you force them to do this, and then once you get accustomed to someone like forced into obeying, then there probably be even worse worse things they try to introduce in the future that they won't get much pushback to, because people have been accustomed to just putting their head down and doing what they're told.
What was the name of that article again by Mr. Stephen Fleury?
Joe Obama's Priorities, Defend the Taliban and Attack America.
We'll be sure to include a link to that in our show notes for today's program. Thanks very much for that, Andrew. We'll take a look now at Europe, where there are fresh calls for the creation of a European Union military. To learn about this, we'll go to Richard Palmer.
European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen gave her State of the Union speech this week. And, these State of the Union speeches usually talk about, they usually have a sentence or two in there or a paragraph on the need for a united European military. But this call for a European military is much more urgent and was really a much bigger part of this speech than is typical. Europe can and really should be able and willing to do more on its own responsibility, she said. She talked about the fact that there would be NATO missions. Well, she said there will be missions where NATO or the United Nations will not be present, but where Europe should be. So talking about not just how Europe having the capacity to be more military involved, but that Europe should be going and taking on more military missions around the world. And then she kind of really zeroed in on the reason why Europe hasn't done more on this front, when she said you can have the most advanced forces in the world, but if you've never prepared to use them, what are they? That is what has held us back until now. It's not just a shortfall of capacity, it's the lack of political will. So she was pushing Europe to do more, to use what Europe has already and what these different member states have already. One of the things that she focused on was a kind of rapid reaction force, where Europe has set up these battle groups. We talked about this a couple of weeks ago. They've got 1,500 soldiers on standby in theory, but they've never been used. So she really encouraged Europe to use those. She talked about how she's going to get together with the French president, Emmanuel Macron, and put together a summit on European defense. And she said it is time for Europe to step up to the next level. So a strong push for more on the military there.
Yes, it does sound like these calls for this EU military are more urgent than what we've heard before. Do you think that the timing of this coming just after the US's withdrawal from Afghanistan has anything to do with that urgency?
Yeah, that's exactly why I think that. I mean, it would have been in the speech regardless, I think. But the fact that it is more urgent and that it is a bigger part of that is exactly because of Afghanistan. It's just, yeah, it's more of Europe just seeing that they can't rely on themselves, or they can't rely on the United States, and they want to step up. They want to do more themselves. And you know, that bit about, well, we need, there are places that Europe needs to be where NATO isn't. That's really talking about what we need to be able to conduct these military missions without the United States.
And from the standpoint of Bible prophecy, this is really right in line with some of the major trends that we're expecting.
Exactly. I mean, this has been something that Herbert W. Armstrong was talking about for years and years. Right from the end of 1945. After Germany was defeated, he was talking about how you'd get a new military power arising in Europe out of a kind of European Union, he called it. And this is exactly the kind of thing that we're seeing. And he said it would start off as an economic union, and then it would become a political union, and finally a military union. And that's exactly what we're seeing within Europe, this same kind of progression. And he also said that it wasn't going to be necessarily an easy or straightforward progression. He talked about the way that that a Frenchman doesn't want to submit to an Italian, and that a German doesn't want to listen to a Frenchman, and that he talked about how it would take crises like the kind of thing we're seeing in Afghanistan to bring them together. That even when they do come together, it will be short-lived. So he anticipated the difficulties that we've seen within Europe as well in bringing about this military union. But he was making all of these forecasts because of Bible prophecy. He was focused on scriptures in Daniel chapter 2 and Daniel chapter 7 and Revelation 13, Revelation 17, where these four passages especially just give an outline of all of world events. And then it talks, this is not God's world. It's a world full of these different ferocious beasts, as they're described in Daniel chapter 7. And it all finishes with this European power that we're seeing rising right now, and that it would be become a major military power. But then all of these prophecies, and Mr. Armstrong emphasized, well, that this is also the last of these beast powers in a world that's cut off from God. And it's all part of God's plan, and it's all leading to a world where God rules instead, and we don't have these kind of powers anymore. But we have an article that goes through all of this at one of our trends articles, Why the Trumpet Watches Europe's Push Towards a Unified Military. It will go through and show you what Europe has done on this front already, where it's leading, and then putting it in this full prophetic context as well.
Why the Trumpet Watches Europe's Push Toward a United Military. We'll be sure to include a link to that in our show notes for today's program. Thanks very much for that, Richard. For the next story, we'll take a look at more U.S. activity that is making America's allies question its reliability, this time in Saudi Arabia. For this, we'll go to Mihailo.
Yeah, so the Times of London reported September 13th that the United States has withdrawn an anti-missile system from Saudi Arabia. They use some of the evidence they use for that is satellite images of Prince Sultan Air Base, which is located 70 miles southeast of Riyadh, and a section of that air base that used to house U.S. anti-missile batteries since 2019 is empty. And this is something that was foreseen. The Pentagon announced months ago that they would be removing several anti-missile systems several defensive systems from Saudi Arabia. And this is at coinciding with timing of the Pentagon claiming that it's having a pivot to Asia to counter China. They've been doing a lot of things lately, like, for example, a military agreement with Australia that's organized to counter China particularly, but it's also coming at the same time as a general U.S. drawdown of the Middle East, like we've seen in Afghanistan, like we've seen how Biden's announced that America is going to be moving out of Iraq. So a lot of people are skeptical that these things are going to be relocated to Asia. Whether there's going to be an Asian pivot or not, they see it as the general drawdown of Washington's involvement in the Middle East.
Well, you can see how this would be just very alarming for the Saudis. And then on top of this missile system withdrawal by the U.S., there was also some disturbing news out of Iran this week that no doubt adds a great deal to the Saudis' concern. Could you talk about that?
Oh, totally. This would be something that really gets the Saudis' attention. Anything that happens in Iran... Saudis and the Iranians are major rivals in the Persian Gulf area, and Iran recently elected a new hardliner president who's putting in an extremist administration. I use air quotes with elected because it was basically all orchestrated by the supreme leader, as all elections in Iran are. But lately, with this change of government and government personnel, Iran has shown itself to be a lot more bellicose, a lot more aggressive to the world. They've ramped up their uranium enrichment. The International Atomic Energy Association recently released a report suggesting that Iran is within a month's time of building a nuclear bomb. And so that's getting under the Saudis' skin, that America, which normally provides Saudi Arabia with most of its protection, most of its weapons imports and other things like that, is disengaging at a time when Iran is starting to rise. And that's making a lot of people in Saudi Arabia question just how valuable the U.S. alliance is and what this means for the near future for Saudi Arabia.
Could you talk about the significance of this in terms of Bible prophecy?
Of course. America, for the last few decades, has been the main guarantor of peace for a lot of the so-called moderate Arabs in the region, Saudi Arabia, the Gulf states, etc. And on the other side of the camp, you have countries like Iran, who are espousing a much more radical version of Islam than the moderate Arabs, who are rapidly gaining territory, like we've seen in Afghanistan recently. There's a lot of evidence, we've written about this quite a bit, that the Taliban have a lot of support coming from Iran. And so as you see this kind of stuff happening, as Iran and radical Islam gaining more and more traction, Saudi Arabia and the other Arabs are getting nervous. And this fits in exactly with two prophecies in particular. One of them is in Daniel 11, verse 40 talks about a king of the south, which we've identified for several decades as being radical Islam led by Iran, taking over countries like Egypt, Libya, other countries in the Middle East, clashing with the king of the north, which is identified as a German-led Catholic European Union, a revived Roman Empire. You have these two power blocks clashing, but one has to wonder, looking at just that prophecy, where do the modern Arabs fit in? You look at another prophecy that we've written about quite a bit lately, for a while. Psalm 83 talks about an alliance that Asher, the ancestor of the Germans, has with certain groups like the Ishmaelites, the Edomites, the Moabites. And those particular groups, if you look at who those peoples are in modern times, those would correspond to a lot of the countries that are, we would call the more moderate countries in the Middle East. So Edom would be Turkey, Moab would be Jordan. And for this particular, our particular purposes, now Ishmael includes the Arabs, especially Saudi Arabia. So we see the Arabs allying with Assyria or Germany to counter. And what would be the main purpose of that will be to counter the king of the south, which is their enemies right now. And so as America leaves the region, where the Ishmaelites, the Arabs, the other peoples in the area, they're going to want to look for a new ally. And the most logical one would be Germany. They've called people have called Germany the leader of the free world often. They're the third largest weapons exporter in the world. And so as the Arabs get more insecure with American security promises, we can see them turning to Europe as their new guarantor of peace while Iran is on the rise.
Mihailo has written an article called Biden's America is Pulling Out of the Middle East. It takes a broad look at the U.S.'s recent foreign policy moves in the region, and it places it all in the context of Bible prophecy. And we will include a link to that in our show notes for today's program, so please be sure to check that out. Thanks very much for that, Mihailo. We'll take a look now at Russia, where a massive set of war games are underway with Belarus, and it has some of their neighbors very worried. For this, we'll go back to Andrew.
Yeah, the president of Ukraine is warning of the possibility of all-out war with Russia. Now, Russia and the neighboring nation of Belarus, which is north of Ukraine, are holding their Zapad 2021 war games this week. Now, these are war games that happen once every 4 years on the border between Russia and Europe. And they're for the purpose of basically conducting simulations of like what would happen if Russia had to go to war with Europe. So I think they said the way they're breaking these down is the first 3 days of the war games, they're anticipating what they'd do in the event of a European attack. And then the next 4 days, they're actually practicing how they do like an offensive assault into Europe. And so these war games, I mean, they've got a huge number, like 200,000 troops, I mean, ships, airplanes, helicopters. They're spread out. They're using actually Crimea, which was part of Ukraine not too long ago, pretty heavily for their naval exercises. But then it also spreads all along the border of Ukraine up actually into Belarus as well.
So this is a very significant set of military exercises, and they're happening just days, really, after the Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline was completed. What can you tell us about any connection there?
Yeah, I think that's what's making the president of Ukraine so concerned this time around. As like I said, so these war games, they do happen every 4 years, but unlike 4 years ago, this Nord Stream pipeline from Russia to Germany is finished. So last time they held these war games, they could at least hold out hope that they're like, well, I don't think Russia would invade the nation of Ukraine proper, at least not for too long, because the gas pipelines that go to Germany and the Czech Republic and Austria and Hungary and these other Central European nations run through Ukraine, and they'll come to bat for us diplomatically because they don't want their energy cut off. At this point, like I said, Nord Stream 1 pipeline has already been completed. The Nord Stream 2 pipeline doubles its capacity. Together, yeah, they pump enough gas that you could completely bypass Ukraine and not need to send any gas through that country into Central Europe. So that excuse now that they wouldn't go to war because of the energy politics no longer holds. Plus, adding another layer of complication on top of that, the United Russia political party, that's the political party that's the main backer of Vladimir Putin, is actually campaigning for political candidates in the Donbass region of Ukraine. That's those two or three provinces of Ukraine right next to Russia, which is huge. That would almost be like, I mean, just to put it in perspective, like as if the Democratic Party in the United States started running candidates in Mexico, and you had one political party with candidates in two nations. But that's what that is actually happening in the Donbass region of Ukraine, which is getting people concerned, many Ukrainians, including the president, concerned that, like I said, he might use Donbass as like the next Crimea, the next secessionist region. You could even see if they're electing Russian politicians and then the Ukrainian government tries to crack down on that at all, you could see some of those weapons currently being so prominently displayed on the other side of the Donbass border crossing into the region.
Yeah, really bizarre development there. And it's got to be illegal for a dozen different reasons, you know, to have citizens of one country, politicians from one country, campaigning in another sovereign country to be you know, various leaders of certain offices. What literature would you point the listeners to if they wanted to understand these kinds of developments in the context of Bible prophecy?
Yeah, we'll put the Prophesied Prince of Russia from our editor-in-chief in the show notes, as well as another article he wrote even a little bit before that entitled The Ukraine Crisis Was Prophesied. That second article about the Ukraine crisis was prophesied was written back basically when Russia was taking moves in the lead up to annexing Crimea. And Mr. Fleury really goes through a prophecy in Ezekiel 38 that talks about this prince, this chief prince of Gog and Magog and Meshach and Tubal and Rus and these nations, like several biblical nations that that today compromise different regions within Russia and the former Soviet Union. And so it's really a very specific prophecy. Is that like a lot of prophecies focus on like one biblical nation, and this lists several, but several that are only found together in Russia. And so it talks about this prince who rises to such power on the world scene. And Mr. Fleury identifies that prince of Russia, as Vladimir Putin, and then takes the next logical step to just really show that, like, well, when you look at if this prince of Russia is going to be a world power, like most of like the former Soviet Union's agricultural land and infrastructure is really in Ukraine. It was really that Ukraine and then the southern parts of Russia, just because of how the climate works over there. Most of Siberia is not very, Russia's a big nation, but it's not very conducive to agricultural produce. That saying that said, really, this is something that if Putin wants to turn Russia into an empire, he's going to need Ukraine to either be part of it or cooperative with it. And so you can definitely see that this crisis now was prophesied in order to bring this prince to power who's, like I said, yeah, being very aggressive with these war games and running candidates in these neighboring nations and annexing even Crimea and maybe even other parts of Ukraine in the future in order to put together this power block that Ezekiel talked about.
The Ukraine crisis was prophesied, and then also the Prophesied Prince of Russia. We'll be sure to include links to both of those in our show notes for today's episode. Thanks very much for that, Andrew. We'll take a quick break now, and when we come back, we'll talk about the EU's answer to China's Belt and Road Initiative, more fallout from the Afghanistan withdrawal, and another milestone by Japan's military. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
China's Belt and Road Initiative has been called the most ambitious infrastructure project in world history. It's been said to be fundamentally altering the world's economic landscape, but now Europe has come up with what looks to be an alternative to it. For this, we'll go once again to Richard Palmer.
Yes, this is another story that comes out of Ursula von der Leyen's State of the Union speech, where she announced that the EU will launch a new global gateway scheme. That's their title, Global Gateway, as opposed to the China's Belt and Road. She said that we want to turn Global Gateway into a trusted brand around the world. We will build Global Gateway partnerships with countries around the world. We want investments in quality infrastructure, connecting goods, people, and services around the world. And she made it clear this was Europe's version of the Belt and Road Initiative. And of course, China uses exactly the same language to talk about its Belt and Road Initiative. You know, this is about creating a network of, you know, China's initiative was all about creating a network of trade links that puts China in the driving seat of world trade. But of course, they talk about it all in terms of infrastructure investment and helping the world and connecting and bringing people together, making links. And so this is Europe saying it's, well, it's their version of that. Ursula von der Leyen said, we're good at financing roads, but it does not make sense for Europe to build these kind of roads between a Chinese-owned copper mine and a Chinese-owned harbor. We have to get smarter when it comes to these kind of investments, you know, implying that they want to be the ones now building the copper mines and building the harbors. So a step up for Europe in terms of investment around the world and getting involved in these different trading links.
So at present, this looks like China and Europe are in competition with each other, but these two initiatives could actually develop in a way that brings China and Europe closer together. And that's exactly what we at The Trumpet are expecting to happen. Could you talk a little about that?
That's right. You know, our focus on this is informed by a whole series of Bible prophecies, but we talked about these prophecies of Europe becoming a military power. But these same prophecies talk about a very strong trade dimension as well. You know, you've got Revelation 17 describing the rise of this European military power. It leads right into Revelation 18 describing this massive economic power that absolutely dominates world trade. There are prophecies that talk about, well, that say that Britain and America would control world trade and they would control these strategic gates to world trade. And it says that those blessings of those strategic gates will be taken away. And so, you know, well, where do they go? Well, you can see these prophecies about Europe getting a hold of them. So world trade is a massive part of this rising European power. At the same time, there are other prophecies that talk about them being in league with China. There's the most noticeably the Mart of Nations prophecy in Isaiah chapter 23 that talks about these two powers, you know, working together to control world trade. And that chapter is full of talk about, you know, merchants and ocean going trade and all of this. So we do expect Europe to have a lot of control of world trade, and we expect them to work with China. But at the same time, that relationship with China is not this really close friendship. You know, the Bible then talks about them falling out later on and going to war against each other. So it's an alliance of convenience. These two both want to bring down the United States, and so they work together to do that. So you can see Europe now, you know, this initiative bringing them a much greater focus on world trade, only to then for them, and sure, maybe some of it targets China initially, but as their focus shifts to kind of more and more to, well, how can we bring down the United States? Well, then you can see how that alliance can then shift to using their new, they can combine their new global gateway with China's Belt and Road Initiative, and you have suddenly a massive control over world trade that you could use against America.
What would you recommend for listeners who would like to read more about this?
So we have a reprint article called The Great Mart of Nations. That's from the July 2016 Trumpet print edition by Mr. Brad McDonald and Mr. Ron Fraser. And that will take you through these prophecies and show you exactly what we're talking about and help you read it from your own Bible.
Well, thanks very much for that, Richard. For the next couple of stories, we'll take a look at some of the continuing fallout from the U.S.'s chaotic withdrawal from Afghanistan. In a moment, we'll talk about some of the radicals who are infiltrating the U.S. as a result of this. But first, we'll look at the radicals still back in Afghanistan and what the United Nations is giving to them. For this, we'll go back to Mihailo.
Yeah, so the big news that's been circulating around for the past month and a bit is, of course, the Taliban takeover of Afghanistan. The Taliban have completely overrun the democratically elected government and formed their own Islamic Emirate. So far, while a few countries like China have kept their embassies open and are doing business with the Taliban, nobody's officially recognized the government yet. But there are certain signs showing that the international community is giving a bit more legitimacy to the Taliban government. And this is the big one from this week. On Monday, September 13th, the UN announced that they would be giving about $1 billion to the Taliban for Afghan relief for supposedly humanitarian reasons. Of course, with the war, there's been a lot of unrest and problems like with people getting aid. And so the UN is sanctioning this large amount of money primarily because the Taliban have sent them a letter, which is basically a plea for international aid. And this letter apparently is convincing enough for the UN to go ahead and get this amount to them.
So this is all predicated on promises of good behavior from the Taliban. What can you tell us about their track record for keeping their promises?
Yeah, well, the letter, as read by the UN's Emergency Relief Coordinator, Martin Griffith, says that the Taliban stating, quote, "We are committed to all rights of women, rights of minorities, and principles of freedom of expression in the light of religion and culture. Therefore, we once again reiterate our commitment and will gradually take concrete steps with the help of the international community," unquote. Now, anybody that has eyes to see, anybody that's been looking at news from the last month and a bit shows that this is exactly not what the Taliban stands for. The stories of, you know, young girls being given to veteran soldiers as child brides comes to mind. A few days ago, The Telegraph actually put up an article about the Taliban parading basically these women covered in these Islamic, or at least according to some interpretations, Islamic dress codes that even covers everything, including the eyes. And as The Telegraph brings out, even like other Muslim societies under Sharia law usually don't go to that extreme. And not only were these women required to wear it, they were being paraded basically for others to see. So how the UN could take any plea of theirs significantly is absolutely mind-boggling. But the U.S., not just the U.N., but the U.S. has also earmarked over $60 million for this same purpose, in addition to the billion to send to the Taliban. So whatever the Taliban are offering behind the scenes, or whatever it, or maybe that the statesmen of the world really just don't really care about all these empty promises that the Taliban are making.
Yeah, it seems like they're eager to overlook that just shameful track record there. So we've devoted quite a lot of time over the last several weeks to showing how Iran has benefited from America's withdrawal from Afghanistan. What can you tell us about how this UN decision might benefit or how it otherwise involves Iran?
Well, for a bit of context, a lot of people, you'll see in a lot of analysts talking about how the Taliban are how the Iranians are a little bit on edge for the Taliban coming in power. They've had their squabbles in the past, but there's quite a lot of evidence to suggest that the Taliban are sponsored basically by Iran. The Taliban have been caught using Iranian-made weapons. There's been evidence showing that the Taliban have actually been training inside Iran. So it's not a rival for Iran. They're in close coordination with each other. But with Iran currently right now, they're in the middle of renegotiating their nuclear deal with the United States, which would unfreeze a lot of assets. America, under the Biden administration, has already unfreezed quite a few assets for the Iranians, billions of dollars worth of assets unfrozen or made available to Iran through other means. So, I mean, it remains to be seen exactly how the Taliban will use this money, but I wouldn't be surprised if somehow Iran was able to siphon off some or to have it to benefit in other ways. And it gives international legitimacy to this Iranian-sponsored group. So, like with the UN, that's about as high of an official body of international recognition as you can get. Now, this is not, of course, a actual recognition by the UN, but if they're giving money to the Taliban, and there's no chance that the democratic government's ever going to be able to get back into power, so it wouldn't make sense for other countries to keep having embassies, for example, like that. So it basically gives Iran a de facto recognition of its takeover of its next-door neighbor, Afghanistan.
Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury has recently recorded a new episode of his Key of David program. It's called The Missing Dimension in Afghanistan, and it really talks about how Afghanistan could even be part of the prophesied bloc. We're talking about the King of the South, which is led by Iran. It's just a very important episode, so we'll be sure to include a link to that in the show notes. It places all of this in the prophetic context. So please check that out if you've not yet seen it. Thanks very much for that, Mihailo. We'll head back over to the U.S. now, where a radical Muslim group is playing a big role in resettling Afghan refugees in America. To tell us about this, we'll go back to Andrew.
Yeah, the State Department still won't let Glenn Beck's Nazarene Fund evacuate persecuted Christians from Afghanistan, but we're finding out that a group called the Islamic Circle of North America is being allowed to resettle Afghani Muslims throughout the United States. There have been tens of thousands of Afghani citizens that the United States was able to get out of Afghanistan before the Taliban closed the airports, and many of them were not vetted very well at all, either before they were evacuated or after they were evacuated. And so now we're finding out that this group, the Islamic Circle of North America, it's actually the American arm of a Pakistani Islamist group called Jamaat-e-Islami, a body that's openly sympathetic to the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, and also sympathetic to many Islamic terrorist groups throughout Pakistan. And this group's arm, it's running a relief charity in the United States, and the chief officer of that relief charity, a man named Abdul Rauf Khan, he's actually an avid fan of Louis Farrakhan here in the United States, the infamous head of the extremely racist Nation of Islam organization. And so he's a fan of his, and he's the one that's in charge of taking these Muslim refugees that America got out of Afghanistan and finding places for them to live in the United States, which a number of media outlets have really raised the question. It's like said, okay, well, if this organization, it's sympathetic to the Taliban, it's sympathetic to Al-Qaeda, it's sympathetic to the Nation of Islam, it has close ties with terrorist group in Pakistan. It's like, so can anyone actually trust that terrorist sympathizers working within the Islamic Circle of North America are not actually infiltrating terrorists into the country? And it really gets back to that first point we made in the first half with that Joe Obama's priorities, defend the Taliban and attack America, in that you've got 143 Christians, Afghanistans, who apparently are not allowed to leave Afghanistan because they haven't been vetted. Mm-hmm. And yet you have tens of thousands of Muslim Afghans who are actually being, who haven't been vetted either, who are being resettled throughout the United States by a group that's, working closely with the terrorist organization in Pakistan.
Very concerning and just bizarre development there. Can you talk about how these events are leading to the fulfillment of Bible prophecies?
Yeah, well, in the show notes, we'll put an article from our editor-in-chief titled Where America's Race Riots Are Leading. And that goes through scriptures in Isaiah 1 and verse 7 that talks about the stranger within your gates burns your city with fire. And then also in Ezekiel 5 and verse 12 that talks about that the burning gets so bad that like a third of the country dies in this civil war-like violence. And so you're seeing several different streams feeding into this violence. I mean, you've got the with the Black Lives Matter, you've got these Marxist groups stirring up racial hatreds between blacks and whites in America's cities. And then you've got the Mexican border, just hundreds of thousands of Mexican and Central American immigrants mixed in with a bunch of drug cartel agents as well, being allowed to come to the United States and perpetrate gang violence and drug trafficking. And now you've actually got like Islamic terrorists from the Middle East that are being deliberately settled in American cities by a group with close ties to terrorism. With the blessing of the United States government, and it's like I said, you start looking at it, it's extremely sinister, and the fact, especially just the double standard that like they're saying that like, well, anyone who's Christian has to be vetted before we'll even consider letting them in the nation. But if this terrorist group in Pakistan says you're okay, then I guess you're okay and you can come and live in our cities.
What literature would you recommend for the listeners who would like to better understand that?
Yeah, actually that article, the Where America's Race Riots Are Leading, it's also a chapter in our booklet, Great Again, that really goes through, that booklet goes through, its overall focus is like how God will eventually make America great again after a time of just some very horrendous punishment that we've brought upon ourselves. But that chapter really does focus in on a lot of what we've been talking about here today, about just this orchestrated campaign to stir up racial violence in the United States.
Well, thanks very much for that, Andrew. And for our final story of the show today, we're going to look at Japan, which has just made another significant move in its march toward military normalization. To bring us up to speed on this, we'll go once again to Richard.
For the first time in about 30 years, Japan's self-defense force, its the ground component, has begun nationwide military exercises. The drills started on Wednesday. They include around 100,000 different personnel, 20,000 vehicles, 120 aircraft. I think the U.S. will be involved to a small extent, a U.S. Army landing ship. It will include Japan's maritime and air self-defense forces. And, you know, like you said, this is significant, really, because this is the first time that they've conducted these kind of exercises since 1993. So this is, you know, basically since the Cold War was winding down and you know, this kind of thing. So it's a move back to a level of militarization that we kind of last saw during the Cold War. It sees Japan getting back to that kind of level. But then also, you know, a lot has changed in the last 30 years or so, where Japan has started, you know, ever since World War II, they have been becoming more and more loose with their definition of what counts as self-defense. You know, of course, Japan does not have an army; it has a self-defense force, which is entirely indistinguishable from an army. But now they've started to get marines and some of these kind of things that they didn't have back in 1993, and now they're including these in some of their drills.
Could you place this in the context of Bible prophecy for the listeners?
Yeah, and I'll point everyone to a trend article that we had once again. This is this time Why the Trumpet Watches Japan's March Towards Militarism, where this was another key prophecy of Herbert W. Armstrong, writing as soon as World War II was over almost, that you would see Japan militarize again, that you would, this is from 1971, a bit of a later quote. He said, Japan today has no military establishment, but we should not lose sight of the fact that Japan has become powerful enough economically. It could build a military force of very great power very rapidly. And, you know, there was a lot of effort put into demilitarizing Japan, even to the point of writing it in their constitution. But Mr. Armstrong and the Plain Truth talked about Japan remilitarizing and these restrictions being lifted. And that is exactly what we've seen. And once again, you know, this was based entirely on Bible prophecy. There are clear prophecies about this a power called the Kings of the East, and that Japan would be a part of this power. It even talks about in Revelation 9, verse 16, that these Kings of the East are going to have 200 million soldiers. So, you know, Japan's not going to be the only member of this alliance, but there'll be an important part of it, especially considering how technologically advanced their military is. And so, as they work on these drills, as they expand their military, we're moving in the direction of these prophecies, and that's why Mr. Armstrong forecast it. And, you know, we've got an unusual schedule and things like that at the moment, because we're keeping the holy days that really help remind us and outline for us God's plan of salvation and for the world. And, you know, these Asian armies, and they play a role in that. They play a role in the return of Jesus Christ and some of these other prophecies. But as these holy days just remind us, you know, it's all part of God's plan, and it's all leading up to some wonderful news as well.
Well, thanks very much for that, Richard. We will include a link in our show notes to the article that he just mentioned there, Why the Trumpet Watches Japan's March Toward Militarism. Or you can find that, along with all the other literature that we've mentioned on today's episode, at thetrumpet.com. So please visit thetrumpet.com for more on these important stories that we've discussed today. Well, we are now coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Please email any questions or comments you may have about today's episode to letters@thetrumpet.com. And thanks very much to our panel today, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Mihailo Zekic. And thanks to Parker Campbell for engineering and production. And we'll leave you today with these words from John Steinbeck. Give me a used Bible, and I will, I think, be able to tell you about a man by the places that are edged with the dirt of seeking fingers. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.